We just want to party.
Hi, I'm Ronald Weaver from Santa Monica. You're listening to WGXC
Acra.
Every Friday on WGXC from noon until 2, check out the Sugar Shack Jukebox featuring decades of funk, R&B, rock, pop, soul, and much more. That's every Friday on WGXC after the noon headlines until 2 p.m.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
Call the WGXC feed.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You've tuned in to All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Acre, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Wednesday, November the 14th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Hate crimes on the rise in the United States. Also on the Wednesday rundown, a big hearing in Denver on a proposed rollback of methane limits. Plus, find out about Give to the Max Day. Now, our top story, reported hate crimes in America rose 17% last year. The Washington Post reporting that's a third consecutive year that such crimes increased. That's according to newly released FBI data that showed an even larger increase in anti-Semitic attacks. Law enforcement agencies reported that 7,175 hate crimes occurred in 2017. That's up from 6,121 in 2016. The Post notes that more than half of the hate crimes, about 3 out of every 5, targeted a person's race or ethnicity, while about 1 in 5 targeted their religion. Today in Denver, the Environmental Protection Agency holds the only public hearing nationwide on its decision to roll back standards designed to reduce methane pollution from oil and gas facilities. More on this story from Eric Galatis.
Conservation groups have asked British Petroleum, which recently moved its headquarters to the Mile High City, to testify against the EPA's proposal. Justin Wasser with Earthworks says this is BP's chance to prove its climate promises are more than just efforts to ease public and investor fears.
These companies have a real risk of losing their social license to operate. And when that happens, the billions of dollars that are invested in this industry are threatened.
After BP promised to eliminate methane pollution throughout its supply chain, Wasser says the company lobbied the Trump administration to weaken methane safeguards. Industry groups have argued that protections are unnecessary because companies have an economic interest in capturing lost methane as the primary component of natural gas and bringing it to market. BP has not yet responded to a request for comment.
Public comments on the EPA proposal must be received by December the 17th. This is American Education Week, celebrating public schools across the U.S. In Massachusetts, one of the messages is that public schools need a lot more financial support.
The Massachusetts Teachers Association is advancing its Fund Our Future campaign this week, asking for more than $1.5 billion in additional education funding. MTA President Mary Najimi says the state's foundation budget for pre-K through grade 12 is underfunded by about $1 billion.
And then our estimate is that higher education is underfunded by more than $500 million a year. So we're talking about $1.5 billion every year.
Najimi was hoping the Fair Share Amendment, or so-called millionaire's tax, was going to be on the November ballot. It was expected to raise $2 billion towards education and transportation expenses. But in June, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled the amendment was unconstitutional because it had more than one purpose, by imposing a tax and stipulating where the funding was going. I'm Laura Ross-Brautelum reporting.
More information on the Fund Our Future campaign is online at massteacher.org. New York is doing relatively well in helping young people in foster care transition to adult life, but there's room for improvement.
A new 50-state report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation shows that nationally, young people leaving the foster care system lag behind their peers in education, employment, and secure housing. It says New York State is a leader in providing effective assistance in those areas, but the state still falls behind in ensuring permanent placement in family settings, an important factor for kids' future success. According to Jennifer March, who heads the Citizens Committee for Children of New York, New York City has reduced the number of foster youth in group homes, but other parts of the state are struggling.
That might be because of the distance between settings, more rural counties, but it's a priority now to begin to reduce the numbers in group homes and residential placement facilities.
The Casey report shows 40% of youth in foster care in the state are in group homes compared to 34% nationwide. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
The report emphasizes the need for state laws and policies that make finding permanent placements for older youth in foster care an urgent priority. Finally, Mary Sherman reports people from across the country and globe expected to open their wallets tomorrow to help support a variety of causes, including those in Minnesota.
Give to the Max Day begins at midnight, and for 24 hours, folks are encouraged to show their generosity and donate to nonprofit groups, charities, and schools throughout the state. It's the 10th anniversary of Give to the Max Day, and Executive Director of Give Minnesota, Jake Blumberg, says they expect to surpass more than 1 million individual donations made to more than 10,000 organizations.
That totaling more than $200 million has really made a huge difference from organizations throughout Minnesota. Every county has both organizations and donors who participate every year. Give to the Max Day is really special and really unique in Minnesota.
Donations can be made online at givemn.org, where early giving started on November 1st. There are about 2,000 groups registered for Give to the Max Day, although each year donors give to thousands more nonprofits and schools. Random prizes are awarded every 10 minutes for donations, and Blumberg says 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. will be power hours, where the nonprofits can compete for a prize.
By the way, Give to the Max Day initially started as a day of giving to launch givemn.org. I'm Mike Clifford. You've been newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts Wednesday there's a 40% chance of snow showers before noon. Then it should turn partly sunny with a high of just 28, a low around 18. Thursday, again, there's a chance of snow, this time after 4 p.m. with a high near 27, low around 24 with more snow overnight. Less than an inch possible, though. Friday, snow before 4 p.m. is again possible. Then it should turn to rain with a high near 34 and a low around 30. Tom Rowe for WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, Creative Community Radio.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeples. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
The Cara Historical Society was established in 2009. Our mission is to collect, study, interpret, and preserve the history of the town of Cara, New York, for the educational and cultural enrichment of present and future generations. We love to bring history alive through our programming, such as our Hometown Heroes banner program, our State of the Union dinners, our Victorian teas. Each teach history while having fun. Members receive absolutely free our quarterly journal, the Cara Herald, which is jam-packed with historical articles, pictures, and society news. Everyone, however, can access the Cara Historical Society's Facebook page, which is a treasure trove of Cara history and memories. It's easy to become part of our historical family. Call Sylvia at 518-821-3852 or email the Cara Historical Society at cairohistosociety@yahoo.com.
This is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Jimmy Valkin reports in the Wall Street Journal that Representative John Faso blames Democrats and the media for his election loss November 6 to Antonio Delgado. He said the media coverage of his campaign was, and I quote, grotesquely biased, end quote. That was an apparent reference to many people calling ads run on his behalf by national Republican groups racist, which one local radio station pulled for that reason. While Faso's blaming of the media may sound like he was in step with Donald Trump, the president criticized Faso days after endorsing him on Twitter. Faso was one of eight Republicans who lost that the president blamed for not embracing his message. Faso said Trump was, and I quote, a big factor in generating the Democratic turnout, so I don't know that being more supportive in a public way would have changed the outcome in any way. It probably would have made it worse, end quote. Read the full story in the Wall Street Journal. Richard Moody reports for Columbia Green Media that new Columbia County Coroner Bernadette Powis says her medical background will provide a different aspect to the role after she defeated Carmen Martino, a retired state trooper, November 6. Powis said, and I quote, "I think investigations would be improved with a medical perspective. Law enforcement is already at the death scene. Having a medical professional will be having a different set of eyes. It adds to what will be shared with a private physician," end quote. Although doctors do the autopsies, she previously was a medical and psychiatric nurse practitioner for 35 years. Powis, a Democrat from Kinderhook, beat Martino, a Republican from Ghent, 12,883 to 11,584 in the special election. Martino had been temporarily appointed coroner August 9th by the Columbia County Board of Supervisors after Dr. Andrea Cricket Coleman resigned in July. Read the full story in HudsonValley360.com. Living Resources, a nonprofit group that works with artists with disabilities, is receiving a $100,000 grant from the Special Needs Program, Inc. which will allow the group to expand its arts program to include pop-up art studios and a gallery. Living Resources CEO Frederick W. Ehrlich said, and I quote, "There is such a great need in the Columbia County region for service programs that we are honored to have been chosen as a recipient of a special needs program grant, which allows us to continue to serve the needs of developmental and brain-injured individuals residing in Columbia County. This gift will preserve the special needs program's legacy for serving individuals with developmental disabilities. It is a wonderful gift that will continue to give back to the community in the form of art for years to come," end quote. The Daily Freeman reports that gassing up the car for Thanksgiving travel this year might be a little cheaper than expected. Last week, the average retail price for gasoline in New York fell 3.9 cents per gallon to $2.90, according to GasBuddy.com. In Greene and Columbia counties, gas prices dropped a penny to $2.89 in Greene and $2.81 in Columbia County. National average prices was $2.67 per gallon, down 5.9 cents from the previous week. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, wgxc.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
National parks and monuments have postponed maintenance for years, and it's catching up with them, but there may be help on the way. More than 400 places have been designated as national parks and historic monuments in the past 100 years, but without a sustained and reliable source of funding to take care of them, the backlog of needed repairs has grown to almost $12 billion. Aaron Tobin with the Preservation League of New York points out that some of those locations are right here in the Empire State.
The Gateway National Recreation Area has $676 million of deferred maintenance projects. There's also the Statue of Liberty National Monument and Ellis Island, which has had tremendous rehabilitation needs for decades.
Congress has taken notice. A bill called the Restore Our Parks Act, which would direct funds to the maintenance backlog, has cleared committees in the U.S. House and Senate. According to Tom Cassidy with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the law would create a fund of $6.5 billion over 5 years, financed by royalties from energy development on federal lands. And it has bipartisan support.
They still need to go to the floors of both bodies and then signed into law. But we are optimistic that we can get this done in the lame duck session of Congress that will end before Christmas.
He says the act would preserve history, provide continued safe access to recreation, create new jobs, and protect local economies that depend on park visitors. Almost 3,000 local, state, and national groups have called on Congress to act. And as Tobin notes, it makes good economic sense, too.
Creating a reliable funding stream for ongoing maintenance will save the federal government a lot of money in the long run because they won't have to play catch-up in the way that they need to right now.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org, and you can add your own by pressing the Add an Event button right there on the page. If you do, folks like me will read your community event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at wgxc.org, including some of these events.
Wednesday, November 14th, there is a special meeting in Rensselaerville to vote on the 2019 budget. That's at 7 p.m. at the Rensselaerville Town Hall out on 87 Barger Road. This weekend at the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, there's a second weekend of Cassie Noisette, a fairy ballet, their version of the Nutcracker. That's at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, and then it's also Friday, Saturday, and I think Sunday, too. Friday, November 16th, there's a job search help at the Hudson Area Library. That's at 10 a.m., and there's Narcan training, 6 p.m. Friday, November 16th, at the Tivoli Free Library. Amanda Brennan, the Public Health Education Coordinator, Opioid Educator for the Dutchess County Department of Behavioral and Community Health, is giving that Narcan training, 6 p.m. Friday, November 16th. Also Friday, November 16th, cello player, singer, and composer Mike Block performs at the Metabee Farm in Hillsdale. That's at 7 p.m. The Jonathan Scales Forkestra is at the Club Helsinki in Hudson at 9 p.m. Friday, November 16th. Saturday, November 17th, there's a tree bark identification hike at the Edmund Niall Hayek Preserve in Rensselaerville. That's at 2:30 p.m. Bill Logan leads the hike to help you learn how to identify trees by their bark. Nathaniel Kahn, Nathaniel Kahn's Academy Award-nominated documentary, My Architect, The Sun's Journey, is screened Saturday, November 17th at 3 p.m. at the Hudson Opera House. Jack Shear's drawings of from the collection of Jack Shear are on view November 3rd through November 25th at the Thompson Giroux Gallery in Chatham. There's an opening for the show at 4 p.m. Saturday, November 17th. The film Brought to Light about the African-American cemetery in Kinderhook is showing 4 p.m. Saturday, November 17th at the Claverick Free Library. Perhaps the world's best guitarist, Richard Thompson, he's playing with an electric trio and an opening band called Sisters of Slide at the Egg in Albany Saturday, November 17th. You can learn more about the Hudson River Valley and the American Revolution Sunday, November 18th at the A.B. Shaw Firehouse in Claverick at 2 p.m. Colonel Jim Johnson, who's in the uniform of the 5th New York Regiment, will be speaking about what went on in the American Revolution in the Hudson Valley. Lavender Suarez gives a community meditative sound bath Sunday, November 18th at 6 p.m. at the Catskill Community Center, 344 Main Street in Catskill. Also Sunday, November 18th, if you're in for some music, the Dust Bowl Fairies, Louis Mojica and Fredo Viola, are performing at Club Helsinki in Hudson at 8 p.m. It's Troika, an evening of fairy tale dream music with those three artists. Monday, November 19th, Annie's Project Workshop is a business education workshop for farm women, a series of classes for women who are farm owners or managers, or who anticipate moving into a decision-making position on a farm. That's at the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Ulster County in Kingston, 9:30 a.m. next Monday, November 19th. These events and more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org. You can find out more there.
Here's Columbia County band Altram with their 2017 release, Set the Controls for Economy Wash. Thank you.
Now you can start. Just read that, and you can improvise, you know, just...
Hi, my name is Tara Klein. I'm from Northeast Parent and Child Society, the largest foster care provider in upstate New York. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, New York.
Excellent. Perfect.
Nervous.
WGXC believes in community. We are a hands-on, participatory radio station and serve many communities. WGXC's volunteer programmers range in age from 9 to 84 and come from all walks of life. What we produce is as varied as the communities that we serve. WGXC is an unbiased source for local news and cultural affairs information. Programming made by and for youth airs daily, and our celebrated music programming is unique, diverse, and eclectic.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
Next, we have these reports.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We are now joined by Dr. James Malazita. Dr. Malazita is an assistant professor in the Science and Technology Studies Department and the Games and Simulation Arts and Sciences Program at RPI. He is also an interdisciplinary researcher whose work combines science and technology studies, media studies, game studies, and the digital humanities. Dr. Malazita is also the founder of the Tactical Humanities Lab. He is here to talk to us about ethics, computer science, and the digital humanities, and to test my reading skills. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
So let's jump right into it. What got you first involved in computer science, and then how did that transition into incorporating humanities?
So before I did my PhD in communication and cultural studies, I was originally trained as a digital designer, so mostly making video games, animation, web design. But I was also interested in kind of the more human elements of study, so anthropology and philosophy. I ended up taking a lot of those courses as an undergrad. And I kind of realized as I was working my way through school that there was a lot of ways that these two disciplines could speak to each other, but they were so siloed in different parts of campus, as well as in the types of readings that they had and the types of intellectual histories that they pulled from, that they weren't really able to speak to each other very well. And so a big part of my PhD and my teaching now is actually trying to resolve for myself that internal crisis of how do we actually get technical disciplines to speak more deeply and to listen more deeply to kind of interpretive, humanistic, and social justice literatures.
Wonderful. And what are some of the key differences between like this section and other popular like computer science sections?
Sure. So for a little bit of context, so the experimental course we're running right now, along with Kritz Totsi, who was featured last week, I believe, on this show, is a social justice variation of Intro to Computer Science or Computer Science 1, where students traditionally learn the basics of how to think about coding and then introduction to Python, a programming language. And the traditional way it's being taught is you go and attend lectures, you're given kind of basic homework assignments where you practice different types of code. Learning code is a lot of just repetition. And so you do lab works and homeworks and tests just to practice the types of coding that you can learn. This type of decontextualized learning, right, where it talks about, oh, we're going to teach you how to code in this abstract way, and then at some point you'll be able to use that code to solve real-world problems, implicitly teaches computer science students that code itself is not political, right? That it doesn't have a history. It doesn't have certain authors who've privileged some aspects of learning over others, that it doesn't come from a certain branch of intellectual history, and that political content of code and education can also serve to alienate certain populations. So, for example, it is not a coincidence that computer science programs tend to be dominated by white men at the undergraduate level. So what we're trying to do in our classroom is recontextualize code. So as students are learning how to program, learning Python, they're also learning about some of the histories that led to the different algorithms and the different social contexts of coding, and then practicing their programming skills by using things like real-world data sets or historical data sets where code, even pre-computer code, has been used to marginalize populations so they can actually learn about kind of the non-neutral ways that you can practice code and then think more deeply about how to practice it better.
And so is this a kind of a mix of what kind of reading materials, I guess? Because I imagine it's got to be, you know, your very technical type manuals, but then also more philosophical stuff. Is that really tough balance to find?
So it's the first time we've run the course, and there's definitely been some bugs along the way that we're going to be debug in the future. So right now, the lecture sections are very technical, and the discussion and homework sections that I personally run tend to be more philosophical, and it actually is really hard to bridge those two. So some of our alternative homeworks and lab assignments do some work at trying to get students to learn and read through coding. But often it can feel as though there's a coding segment of the class and then there's a discussion segment of the class. And it's better than having no discussion segment, but we're actually trying to learn how to better incorporate discussing and thinking about political influences and philosophy through the act of coding. So that's something we're kind of polishing up still.
One way that we see a lot of different messages going through these days are through video games. Is there a lot of talk about the ethics of video games as you go through the course?
Sure. So right now the course is aimed more at computer science students in general, but as you might guess, there is a heavy overlap between game students and computer science students, as well as computer science students and those who, students who are just interested in playing games. So some of the content that we have in the course and then in the games major talks a lot about narratives in video games, so ways that we can think about issues of representation, issues of who's allowed to produce games and who's not, who has access to technological means of game production. We're still trying to work in a little bit more of a deeper underlying how do games work in ways that actually privilege and deprivilege different kinds of stories. So not just storyline content, but different ways of telling stories.
Do you find that the earlier age that someone is exposed to, like, their first coding, you know, whether it's like a website that kind of gives you a tutorial, or maybe they had a class in middle or high school, do you find that that then has a larger impact on whether they follow it, or do you find that there's just as many people who pick it up in college and it doesn't make a huge difference?
So it makes a big difference, but actually in a couple different ways, as power tends to do. So it's certainly true that students who have had experience with programming and coding, and honestly, even just playing video games, for example, because video games are so code-like in their narratives, tend to be able to pick up the logics of programming a little bit easier. However, there can be a problem because of the structures of higher education where students, especially students of color and women who have learned how to code through things like Black Girls Code and all these wonderful K-12 kind of women and students of color in STEM programs, are taught at the grade school and high school level that their identities are core to who they are, that their identities are core to their position as a programmer, and that computer science and STEM can really radically benefit from their participation. Once they get to college, all of that stuff is switched. So they're kind of baited in through these identity-focused, social justice-focused programs, and they get to college and they're often told, your identity doesn't matter. Society doesn't really matter until your senior year when you've mastered code. And those students actually tend to have a harder time, even though they have previous coding background, because their understanding of the boundaries between society and code are being explicitly challenged.
See, that's really fascinating to me that they then have that issue as soon as you get into it. So what options do these graduates have then for getting back into it? What are the kinds of careers that are open to someone who becomes a master in coding, but also with this deeper understanding of social justice?
So there's certainly lots of nonprofit organizing and kind of consultancy. Google and Silicon Valley are very invested in diversity and inclusion programs, somewhat shallowly sometimes. So there's certainly that. But we're actually hoping that many of these students can go into really standard basic computer programming jobs because we not only want to change the culture from the top down by rethinking what education does, but want to change the culture from the bottom up. So get into these entry-level positions, bring these values, bring these literacies with you so that as you work your way up inside programming firms or inside companies, you're able to bring these kind of narratives and issues of social justice up with you.
Well, thanks. Kalina, do you have a question?
Yeah, so are there ways to really work on not only the coding and kind of the ethics work, but also developing like the leadership and confidence of the coders while they're coming up through like through your program to kind of get them a little more confident when they step into these programs and like kind of, you know, move forward into the, it seems like a really competitive world of coding and Yeah,
it's not only a hyper-competitive world, but a hyper-masculine competitive world. The number, despite a lot of the women in STEM recruitment programs that have been going on since the mid-90s, the number of women graduating from computer science programs has actually been decreasing over the past decade. And the number of women employed in computer science has been decreasing even more rapidly. So there's a huge shrinking pipeline problem. So the two ways we try to help address it, because we're one point in the structure, is one, very consciously creating an open and supportive attitude in our computer science classrooms, which is not the norm in all, not specifically RPI, but many technical classrooms where there's a privilege of content over conversation. So how can we actually build students' confidence and capacity within a learning environment? And then we're trying to broaden the project to work with more student multicultural groups on campus, particularly the Black Students Association and Alianza Latina, to help them work with us to work with students on campus about how to bridge more of these technical elements and issues outside of computer science classrooms and, frankly, outside of classrooms in general that women and students of color, of course, face all the time on a STEM-focused campus. So how do we build those capacities for our students as well?
And what about the students that you would more typically see in these classrooms? Is there any work done about kind of like including them and helping them, I guess, kind of open their eyes and make them feel a little more open-minded to having, I guess, being more inclusive or being more open to having more diverse, having a more diverse student base in their classrooms?
So yes and no. So the kind of pie in the sky dream of myself in terms of computer science, one is this becomes no longer a special opt-in small section, but becomes the standardized way in which computer science is taught, right? That you learn not only in order to be a computer scientist, you have to be a good programmer, but you have to be a deep social thinker as well. Currently on campus, and this is pretty common in many science programs, you do have to take courses in sociology or the humanities. And that theoretically makes you a more socially conscious person. But what we find often happens is students who are already kind of hesitant to engage in those conversations, the fact that they have to leave their majors, so computer science, biology, engineering, go across campus to the social sciences departments or humanities departments to learn these issues, it implicitly reinforces to them that these issues are alien to them, right? That they don't need it. They're externalized. They're extra. Mm-hmm. And so part of this is trying to curricularly build these kind of issues back into their technical classes.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. I didn't have any other questions except do you plan on running the course again in the next semester?
So we will be offering the course again in the spring semester, and we're hoping that starting in the fall of 2019 that we'll be able to offer not only one section but a couple of larger sections, hopefully by recruiting some of our students who are currently in the class now to act as mentors and ambassadors for a new generation of students.
Wonderful.
Well, fantastic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that was Dr. James Malazita, RPI professor, discussing ethics, computer science, digital humanities, and game.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Amanda Purcell is reporting for Columbia Green Media. ShopRite will likely open its new location at 351 Fairview Avenue in Greenport by the end of the year, a top company official recently told the paper. ShopRite's pharmacy is already operating at the new location, the site of the former Price Chopper store, but renovations are underway in the space which will contain the supermarket. Tom Ertz, Vice President of Operations for ShopRite Supermarkets, Inc., said in a statement, and I quote, ShopRite is committed to keeping the pharmacy open to customers during the renovation, and we look forward to moving into a newly renovated supermarket later this year, end quote. ShopRite will continue to operate from 70 Healy Boulevard during the renovations. Mona Gold, Price Chopper's Vice President of Public Relations and Consumer Services, said Price Chopper shuttered its Greenport store in September due to the area's economic decline. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Rachel Silberstein is reporting for Capital Confidential. As Democrats prepare to take control of the state Senate, upstate secessionists are using the moment to bolster support for their idea of a two- or three-part state. Divide NYS is a group critical of what it perceives as a downstate-focused state government. It is asking its supporters to press local, town, and county officials to sign a resolution in favor of creating the autonomous region, New Amsterdam. Critics have questioned the economic viability of an upstate New York that is separated from New York City. The secessionist movement in New York remains fairly small, but it has picked up steam over the possibility of certain legislation, like various gun control measures and the New York fracking ban. Read the full story at Capital Confidential. Sarah Tafton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The distinctive wail of the Catskill Village fire alarm is a thing of the past, since the Catskill Fire Company started using new high-band pagers on November 7th. The upgrade is part of a multi-million dollar countywide project to increase coverage for firefighters. Assistant Chief Patrick McCullough said, and I quote, "Our pagers would trip 50% of the time on low band. High band uses all the towers. Now they will trip no matter where we are," end quote. McCullough said the new system is 100 times better than the old. "There are no dead spots," he said. William Lawrence, chairman of the Greene County Legislature Public Safety Committee, said, and I quote, "It will be more reliable and requires less manpower than the old system," end quote. All members of the Catskill unit have been outfitted with the new pagers, and the high-band radios have been ordered. The historic old siren will not be retired completely, however. It will be switched on manually at low-band frequency the first Tuesday of each month between 6 and 7 p.m. when the firefighters meet, McCullough said. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Keisha Clucky is reporting for Newsday. The number of international students studying at universities and colleges in the United States rose 1.5% to a new high of 1.09 million during the 2017-18 academic year, according to the latest Open Doors report just released by the Institute of International Education. During the last school year, there were more than 121,000 international students enrolled in colleges in the state of New York, up 2.4% from the year prior. Those students contribute nearly $5 billion to the state's economy, according to the report. New York has been second to California, the number one host state in the country since at least 2001. The New York institutions with the highest number of enrolled international students were New York University, Columbia University, SUNY Buffalo, Cornell, and SUNY Stony Brook. Students from China and India made up more than 50% of international students studying in New York, followed by South Korea, Canada, and Taiwan. Schools nationwide have been seeing declines in the number of new international students, even as total international enrollment rose, according to the report. The slowdown is attributed to a range of factors, including the rising cost of college in the U.S. and increased competition from other countries, with China and India working to retain their own students. Read the full story in Newsday. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, wgxc.org. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Graham. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts Wednesday there is a 40% chance of snow showers before noon. Then it should turn partly sunny with a high of just 28, a low around 18. Thursday, again, there's a chance of snow, this time after 4 p.m. with a high near 27, low around 24 with more snow overnight. Less than an inch possible, though. Friday, snow before 4 p.m. is again possible. Then it should turn to rain with a high near 34 and a low around 30. Tom Rowe for WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, Creative Community Radio.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
What is your radio show?
Only dogs can hear. Wednesday, November 14th, tune in to special programming on WGXC 90.7 with the Hudson Cafe at 11 a.m. featuring Bob and Ray, Nichols and May, and other comedic songs to go along with those skits. 2 p.m., Something to Talk About features an interview with Columbia County Treasurer P.J. Keeler live from the Hudson Studio in the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. At 4 p.m., the WGXC Afternoon Show talks to sports writer Tim Martin, who recaps the Turkey Bowl basketball game, and Rashad Barksdale also calls in to talk about the game at the third annual Thanksgiving community dinner. There'll also be music from Jana Donnell, Christopher Barton, Foxy Blanco, and Johnny Blaze from 4 to 6 p.m. 7:30 p.m., tune into an extra web stream from Dan Udell, who brings you the Columbia County Board of Supervisors meeting. 9:30 p.m., the 2045 show signs off for the final time with host Alex Benson on WGXC.org and 90.7 FM.
Are you looking for a child development program for your preschooler? Columbia Opportunities Head Start offers full-day early childhood development activities and support to eligible 3- and 4-year-olds throughout Columbia County at no cost to families. School readiness, health, nutrition, and parent engagement activities are offered throughout the year. Head Start classrooms are located in Hudson, Philmont, Taconic Hills, Volusia, and Chatham. Give your child a head start. For more information, 518-828-6312 or columbiaopportunities.org.
Next, it's time for the Hudson Valley Song of the Day, a performance from a musician visiting the Capital Region or Hudson Valley, or who regularly plays around these parts.
Here's Columbia County-based Steely Dinn, Slink Moss, and PG6 with Skipping Tones, 2017 Local Music. Thank you.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
This is Echo. You are listening to WJFC Acra, Creative Community Magical Radio.
I'm a rogue.